Thanks for making it to the Sunday morning session. So I'm just going to jump right in. So this panel is titled Sexual Violence in the State. So I want to start by explaining what I mean when I talk about the state in this presentation, and by making a distinction between, broadly speaking, what I understand to be two distinct arms or wings of the state. So the first is the repressive apparatus of the state, so what we usually think of when we hear the word state, right? The repressive apparatus that has a monopoly over what is considered legitimate violence in society. So the legal system, right? Jails, prisons, police, the military, intelligence agencies, that kind of thing, that have the power to determine who gets included, excluded in society, and how, and that have the sheer sort of brute force and institutions to enforce that. The second is, for lack of a better description, the non-repressive apparatus of the state, constituted for the most part by government services and largely non-repressive agencies. So things like the Postal Service, right, or the Environmental Protection Agency, that kind of thing. But of course, just because these aren't repressive in the same way as, for example, the police, doesn't mean that these, you know, what I call non-repressive bodies are neutral in any way. You know, anyone who has received public education in this country knows that just because its primary function is not repressive in the same way, doesn't mean it's not shaped by the inequality and the oppression that our society is built on. I also want to add that even though I think it's analytically important to distinguish between these two different roles of these two different wings of the state, broadly speaking, they very much do overlap, particularly since the onset of neoliberalism. And it's very clear if you look at the history of the anti-sexual violence movement of the second half of the 20th century, which I'll briefly touch on in this presentation, and we can talk more about in discussion, it becomes very clear that these do overlap in significant ways. Again, to continue with the example of public education, right, we know that there are far more cops in schools than nurses or guidance counselors or mental health professionals. So in this presentation, I'll be focusing on the explicitly repressive part of the state, and that's what people should assume I'm talking about when I use the word state, unless I specify otherwise. So how is sexual violence defined in our society? Of course, as we know too well, people have all sorts of ideas about what it means, right? What sexual violence means, the definition of it. But the definition taken to be, quote unquote, legitimate, because even if we consider, is whatever the state considers to be sexual violence. And I use square quotes around legitimate, because even if we consider the state's understanding of sexual violence to be untrue or imprecise or, you know, one-dimensional or heteronormative or harmful, which I do, it is still the understanding that is operative whenever an individual, whether it be a survivor or a perpetrator of harm or someone who they know or love, attempts to seek any recourse, right, in any entity that's not a single individual or a group of individuals that is not recognized by the state. So if anyone tries to seek recourse in the healthcare system, right, the mental health resources, the legal system, the operative definition is the one given by the state, the legal definition. In any of these situations, this definition entails a particular perception of an act, right? But it's not a definition that is trans-historical. It hasn't been the same forever. It's shaped by specific historical context and the legacy of political struggles. Different societies define which non-consensual sexual acts, and even which consensual sexual acts, right? Think about the history of homosexuality or the age of consent, right, of participants. So which acts to criminalize at different points in history, right? Which to condone, and how forcefully and in what ways to deal with and prosecute them. And this is what shapes which narratives, right, which people, usually white wealthy women, may charge which other people, right, usually working class poor, men of color, particularly black men, with the crime of forceful unwanted sex, and whose accounts will be believed. And I use the word crime because that's what legal definitions are, right? They define what is and is not a crime and what is and is not an act to be punished by the state. So having said that, I think it's important to not flatly understand all legal outcomes of fights around sexual violence as impossible to be victories just because they're within the framework of the state. right, efforts to define and redefine sexual violence, to contest the ways that the state understands and deals with sexual violence have always been a part of struggles around sexual violence and have been hugely politically important. Generations of women's rights and racial justice activists have contested the narrow racist understanding of rape as a brutal attack on a chaste, unmarried white woman by a stranger, right? Usually a working class or poor black stranger. You know, they fought against a legacy of lynching black men over the accusation of raping a white woman. Or to take another example, you know, very few legal systems in the world criminalized marital rape before the 1970s, right? And while we can say that, yes, we want a world, of course, without prisons and police and, you know, maybe even some of us without a state, in a context in which the state repeatedly fails to recognize and protect people from sexual violence, and in fact often denies sexual violence and perpetrates it, both at home and abroad, and criminalizes survivors, the state being forced, even within the framework of its own logic, the state being forced to recognize sexual violence as a phenomenon serious enough to warrant acknowledgement and redress is a reflection of a broader ideological victory. Even if we don't necessarily count that victory, meaning more criminalization, right, as a victory in and of itself. And as the Me Too movement has shown us, conceptions of what sexual violence is continue to be contested and not only in legal terms, but also socially, right? How we understand sexual violence in society, but not necessarily sort of in the legal definition. And those two things are obviously not unrelated. I also think it's important just to say that we shouldn't shame survivors who seek recourse in the state. There are many things that may force someone to do so, or people might just want to do that. And you know, we can talk about a discussion. I know it's an authority question, right? So having said that, I want to very briefly go over some history, just for people to get a sense of how what I'm talking about has played out concretely. By far the broadest reach of state power in relation to sexual assault happened as an outcome of the anti-rape movement of the 1960s and 70s in this country, which transformed sexual violence, for better and for worse, into a social, medical, and legal problem. In the US, increasingly coercive state reactions to sexual violence started particularly in the early 1970s, during which awareness of the problem of sexual violence went together with a phenomenal growth in the crime control apparatus, including increased prosecutorial power, right, mandatory sentences, and an unprecedented rise in the prison population, what we call mass incarceration. At the same time, there was a development of a large professional apparatus, right, an apparatus expertise, in response to sexual violence. And both signaled a societal reckoning and a taking seriously of the problem, as well as the restriction of options for survivors within the expanding systems of medicalization and criminalization, which is, you know, as we know, it's almost impossible to understand the causes and consequences of violence in terms that, you know, don't fit squarely within those purviews of medicalization and criminalization, and that have been enormously harmful. Of course, you know, medicine, the legal system, et cetera, don't take into account questions of oppression, right? They don't take into account how social relations and people are shaped by things like sexism and racism and homophobia, or how complicated desire and sex are for people under capitalism, right? That's just true. In this context, the anti-sexual violence movement became a partner in the unforeseen growth of a criminalized society, which, as we know so well, devastates the lives of women, of black people, of immigrants, queer people, right? The same people who disproportionately experience sexual violence in the first place. And the rise of mass incarceration and all the things that came along with it were not only devastating in their own right, and not only, you know, increased the criminalization of groups of people and communities who are already the most oppressed in society, but also led to the resurgence of the rape myths that the anti-sexual violence movement had fought so hard to debunk, right, in the 60s and 70s. The most notable one being that the quote-unquote real rapists are the quote-unquote criminals, right, the poor black men, you know, the black and brown strangers on the street, and not your husband or the obnoxious guy in your math class. And I think this is particularly pointed in our current era, in which rich and powerful men are being publicly accused of harassment, assault, and rape. And whatever one may think of that and the repercussions that they have faced, it's telling that it's not the repressive carceral punitive system that has overwhelmingly responded to these cases. And I think it's very clear in today's context of Me Too to see that. By the late 1970s, the introduction of neoliberalism as a particular mode of ruling society, and especially with the Ronald Reagan administration beginning in 1981, meant less restraint on free market policies, pro-corporatism, privatization, the transfer of public services to private organizations, the attack on workers and the labor movement. You really go down the line. This brought out the tension between, on the one hand, organizers' rightful calls for the state to actually take responsibility for preventing violence and giving resources to survivors, and on the other hand, the new sort of neoliberal ethics of personal responsibility. And this tension was resolved through the incorporation of the feminist anti-rape movement into the apparatus of the regulatory state, by the state imposing all sorts of conditions and restrictions onto the ability to actually help survivors, to access services. To give an example, which survivors were allowed into shelters, this tying of services and funding of rape crisis centers to reporting rates directly, meaning you could only access funding, you could only access services if you had met a certain quota of reports to the police. Things like abortion, like if you need to get an abortion, you need to report your rape in cases where only abortion was allowed for rape or incest. The jeopardization of custody, the children of survivors, all sorts of details that I won't go into here, but we can talk about in discussion, but really the incorporation, the co-optation of the rightful call on the state to actually take responsibility and provide services to the criminal apparatus of the state, which is how the two wings of the state that I sort of talked about at the beginning were able to come together in a very concrete way. So I'll leave it at that in terms of the historical component that I wanted to go over, and I just want to wrap up because I really want to leave time for my other panelists and the discussion. But I think as people who organize against sexual violence and who have inherited both the gains and the failures of the anti-rape movement and the feminist movement and the anti-racist movement that have preceded us, we are confronted by a number of tensions and questions about how to fight endemic sexual violence in society, how to address violence under capitalism at all and the relationship of that to the state, and how to deal with this incorporation of a supposedly anti-sexual violence agenda into the repressive apparatus of the state. And I just want to end by listing some of these tensions and questions, and hopefully they can be helpful in guiding the discussion, or maybe it can just get folks to start thinking about things. The first is, for those of us who are Marxists or who have a class-based analysis of society, we understand that the violence of powerful people in society is very different than the violence of working class people in society. The social position of the perpetrator matters a great deal. A Harvey Weinstein or a Brett Kavanaugh or a Trump is very different than your next door neighbor or the stories of assault that we're so used to hearing from our loved ones and our friends. And what do you do with that, you can say that's true. What does that mean in terms of how we fight and how we understand addressing sexual violence under capitalism and the different approaches we should take to different kinds of violence and perpetrators? The second thing I wanted to raise is the question of punishment in general, particularly outside of the context of law and prisons and police. So in communities or in institutions that are not the state, and I think there's actually a quite unhelpful and harmful conflation of institutions broadly and the state. So for example, a school is not the same as the state. They're related, but they're not the same. A workplace, similarly. So what to do with possible desires for retribution, which I think we should acknowledge, how do you actually deal with that in a way? And I think that's also tied to the first question of depends on the perpetrator, And lastly, I just wanted to raise the question of demands how to make demands from the non-repressive apparatus of the state. And how to make sure that they won't get co-opted into the repressive apparatus like happened in the 1970s in the anti-rape movement. Because I think we have to deal with the question of punishment, broadly speaking. I also think it's true that for most survivors, justice looks more like having the resources to deal with the violence that they've experienced and alleviating the conditions of that violence in the first place, right? Trying to eradicate the roots of violence than it does with locking someone up. I think that's generally true. Things like universal healthcare that includes reproductive rights and mental health services, right? Free housing, free childcare, paid maternity leave, quality public education, quality sex education, right? Raising wages so you can leave, unions. Those are the kind of demands I think we should be talking about as being part of an anti-sexual violence movement in this country. I think we have to understand our tasks as trying to build that right now, especially in this sort of pointed era of Me Too, where it feels like everyone's talking about things and there's a moment, but there's not exactly a mass movement that you can sort of point to. So I will just leave it at that. I hope that was sort of like a helpful framework to think about things, and I'm excited for discussion.
Thank you so much, Camila. Our next speaker will be Dina.
Good morning, everybody. First, I'd like to thank the organizers of the conference, including Elizabeth, for asking Love and Protect to take part of the conference and to talk about our work. Second, I want to recognize that many of us in here are holding a lot of pain and trauma, not only in this room, not only in this space, but in our everyday lives. So as Elizabeth mentioned, please make sure to take care of yourself, not only here at this time, but also when we leave here. And remember that our fights are ultra marathons and not sprints, and we need to take care of ourselves. So thinking about sexual violence in the state. So the current resurgent of the Me Too movement, which was started 10 years ago by Tarana Burke of Girls for Gender Equity, has really continued to bring sexual assault, harassment, and abuse into the light in different industries. Entertainment, politics, academia, business have all been shaken, and necessarily so, with the uncovering of long-held, not-so-secret secrets of people who cause harm, abusers, in these often tight-knit spaces. So while the Me Too movement has swept the U.S. and seemingly has helped to empower women to reveal the abuse and harm they received and name the people who abused them and caused harm, there's one particular industry or space that really hasn't been touched, and that's the criminal legal system. So my approach to the Me Too movement and what I want to talk about today is understanding the necessity and importance of it, but also to criticize the Me Too movement, including the Pink Pussy Hat Brigades at large, and that they leave out critical voices and bodies that have been marginalized, essentially disposed of, and silenced. Right? This is incarcerated and court-involved trans and non-trans women, gender non-conforming people, and trans men. So I want to talk a little bit about the way that mainstream anti-sexual assault movements, discourses, and organizations are constructed, that incarcerated women, gender non-conforming folks, will not be part of those movements and will not benefit from policy changes, if there are any policy changes resulting from these movements, because incarcerated women cannot occupy the perfect victim, capital P, capital V, role that people can rally around. And I'm gonna talk about, I'll define perfect victim in a little bit, but it really dovetails with what Camila was saying about the state-legitimized definitions of sexual violence. Let me just be absolutely clear about my positionality. Prisons should not exist. Thank you. Yelling to the choir. In my beautiful, yeah. They, as many of us know, are sites, all different sites, they are all sites of different types of violence, including sexual violence. And so they should be eradicated, dismantled, immediately, if not sooner. Okay, so here I want to talk about DV, domestic violence and sexual assault organizations and the broader public that hold on to the paradigm of the perfect victim. So let me describe her, using my pronouns very purposefully here. She is a cisgender, innocent woman, has done no wrong in her life, often educated past K-12, stably employed in a respected industry or stay-at-home mother, or some combination of both, has stable housing, has no criminal history, and did nothing wrong to deserve the abuse or assault. These stories speak to a large group of people who can sympathize or even empathize with the person who can't get behind a working mother with multiple degrees, a house, a solid, stable job, who is sexually harassed and assaulted in the workplace. Similarly, who can't get behind women in Hollywood who fit mainstream ideas of beauty and grace, are great at their craft, are philanthropists and well thought of, whose images are known worldwide, who can't get behind Uma Thurman, Meryl Streep, Reese Witherspoon. So it makes sense like these types of women, these tropes, and actual women are pushed to the forefront of this movement because we've been forced to identify with these images of women as good and laudable for so long, because we in the public can say, wait a minute, if they were raped, if they were assaulted, I could be too. Could my sister, my daughter, my girlfriend, my mother, could that happen to them too, if it happened to them? So we can identify to some extent with these women, and recognizing that sexual abuse and assault are widespread types of violence that can happen to anyone is a great idea. Yeah, we want to be able to say that this can happen to anybody, right? But we can't just identify it with the person who fits what we're calling this perfect victim role. We have to say, if anybody can be raped, if anybody can be assaulted, abused, harassed, then that means everybody and anybody, right? Regardless of gender identity, regardless of sexual identity, that everybody can be in this abused, or can be abused, can be harassed, so on and so forth. Also, side note, I'm not gonna get into this today, but that also means that any one of us can also cause harm. So we gotta hold those together. And when talking about these perfect victims, these aren't even the women that Tarana Burke had in mind. In fact, she was talking about young girls of color who were sexually abused, harassed, and assaulted at home, at school, around schools, right, around places that are supposed to be safe. And when she talked about the first time she wanted to say Me Too was when a young black girl who was considered trouble, right, as many black girls are viciously mistakenly considered. So when this black girl disclosed the sexual assault to Tarana, and Tarana couldn't, and when was unable to do so in return, and instead directed her to another person for assistance, she realized that she should be able to say Me Too, that this happened to me and I can actually work with you. I don't have to have this distance because we've experienced very similar things and we can work through this together and to heal together, right? And many of us have done something like this, that we've made that distance even when we've wanted to say Me Too, and we've wanted to say Me Too in a variety of reasons. So I wanna hold that, but then also talk about incarceration, and specifically incarceration of black women and girls who aren't able to say Me Too. And if they do say Me Too, there aren't enough people who are listening. And when I say enough people with power to stop the harm from occurring, right? And these incarcerated girls and women I'm speaking of are disproportionately black and Latinx. And according to the ACLU, black women represent 30% of all incarcerated women in the US. And Latina women represent 16% of incarcerated women, although respectively, they only represent 13% black women and 11% Latinx of all U.S. women population, right? A couple of other facts I kind of want to throw at you from Color of Change, Survived and Punished, and ACLU. There are 832% more women in prisons now than there were in 1977. That's fucking asinine.
Yeah.
832% more, right? I mean, I'm not even good at math, and I'm like, how can you have 800%, right? One in 10 are sexually assaulted in prison, and that's a very low estimate, right? Because it's difficult to disclose, yeah, right, when you're on the outside, but it's certainly difficult to disclose to the people that are assaulting you, mm-hmm, or are allowing the assault to happen, mm-hmm, that are complicit in the assault. More than 80% of women incarcerated experience domestic violence, child abuse, and or sexual abuse slash assault prior to incarceration, right? And again, another conservative number. In some women's prisons, up to 94% of the women are survivors of sexual assault and or physical abuse. 90% of women incarcerated for killing their boyfriend or husband did so to protect themselves, mm-hmm, right? And so Rachel worked on this beautiful art exhibit, No Selves to Defend, about that there are only certain people who are allowed to defend themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not these women who are currently incarcerated. And what Camila was saying, that women who are, you know, coming from low-income areas, who are women of color, who are trans, who don't identify as women, who are not allowed to defend themselves, right? And we see that often. So these stats and more that I don't have represent a number of things: that there's trauma before being incarcerated, that people are re-traumatized after being incarcerated, and if on the chance of release, right, like when we when people are getting out of prison, that there's continued trauma coming back into society, right? Because of the services that are not, or because of the lack of services, I should say. And so none of this, the things that I've just said, all of these stats do not match up with the perfect victim paradigm. And because it doesn't match up with the perfect victim paradigm, it's much easier for the larger public, but more importantly, mainstream DV and SA orgs, to not get involved in cases. Right? It's also easy to not get involved in their lives. It's easier to say, well, yeah, we kind of hear your Me Too, but like this person over here, this person really needs our support. And so instead, we continuously silence the incarcerated women when they're talking about the harm that they experience and that the different services they need. And so let me also say that it's not only, so the people who are incarcerated are experiencing and have experienced this sexual violence, but being in a prison, being caged, is another form of violence, right? So just want to say out loud, prisons are not feminist.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. And the prison industrial complex is certainly not feminist, right? So the criminal legal system is, we hear this especially around elections, people are going to get tougher on crime and they're going to, you know, they're going to put people in prisons and that's where punishment is meted out and, you know, they're going to get rehab. And so it's all about punishment. It's never about justice, right? The label of criminal is mapped onto people, and the newly labeled, or I should say officially labeled, because black bodies are already criminalized, regardless of our status within the criminal legal systems. So these officially labeled criminals are banished until they serve their time, serve their debt to society, and should come back to be ready to be productive citizens after atoning for their missteps and crimes. Okay? That's the idea. But some of the most vulnerable of US society are incarcerated people, and the people that I've mentioned, trans women, non-trans women, trans men, and gender non-conforming folks. particularly people of color, are locked away with these stark buildings with limited access to the outside world, and vice versa. These people are on the inside are facing startling violence and dehumanization that should shock us all. And so we hear different stories about these kind of one-off stories, and I hope you hear about these stories, maybe not. But we hear stories of transgender women who are already not centered in the Me Too movement and are summarily pushed aside and stepped upon by the Pink Pussy Hat Brigades. They face violence in jails that serves only to deepen the transphobia that undergirds our nation. And for instance, trans women and trans men are often misgendered and placed in prisons that do not match their gender identities or expressions, which puts them in extreme danger and often serves to punish them more, right? Where is the Me Too for those people? I'm gonna skip ahead to talking about that we know prisons are dehumanizing, and for these folks who are experiencing this dehumanization, this sexual assault, sexual abuse, this rape, where was that in the sentencing process? So when these folks were went to trial, where did it say that part of their punishment should be continued sexual abuse, right? How does this violence, besides the violence of being incarcerated, where does that appear on the court documents that detail their prison terms? Where does it appear on their court records? How does this mean justice or rehabilitation? And what debt is being served for the violence that they experience? So I talked a little bit about policies at the beginning of my remarks. Will policies change? I don't think so, unless there is a forced change. And for people who are incarcerated, I don't, policies trickle down very slowly and force changes are very small. Especially since prisons and jails can't even do the bare minimum for women to sustain women and trans women, gender non-conforming folks, non-trans women and trans men, I should say, to sustain a modicum of a healthy life. Then the chances that the wardens, the sheriffs, the CEO, corrections officers, prison companies addressing sexual abuse and rape complaints is zero, I would say. And that's not even being pessimistic. That's being realistic, unfortunately. And when I say the bare, I mean, they don't even provide for people who have menstrual cycles. So people might have to buy their pads and tampons, right? Or if they're provided pads and tampons, they get 12 for a cycle, or they're paper thin, or all of that, right? Housing multiple people, housing 3-4 people in a 2-person cell, not providing toilet paper, not providing soap, issuing underwear once a year, right? This is like the very basics that people are not being provided in prison. And so with all of that, I want everyone to remember, as we talk about in Survived and Punished, that we need to remember survivors include people with prior arrests and criminal records, undocumented immigrants, sex workers, people who work in street economies, people who use or sell substances, so that it's important to challenge the idea that survivors and criminals are two diametrically opposed groups, right? So, and we want to affirm the lives and self-determination of all survivors of domestic and sexual violence. And so I typically like to end with a directive, so I'll probably do that a little bit later, but I would like to end with some soothing and revolutionary words from our Lord, Audrey. So this is from A Litany for Survival. It's the end of the poem. And she says, and when the sun rises, we are afraid it might not remain. When the sun sets, we are afraid it might not rise in the morning. When our stomachs are full, we are afraid of indigestion. When our stomachs are empty, we are afraid we may never eat again. When we are loved, we are afraid love will vanish. When we are alone, we are afraid love will never return. And when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak, remembering, we were never meant to survive. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Dina. Rachel will be our final speaker.
All right. How's everyone doing? Is this close enough for everybody? How's everyone doing? How's whoever said they were still hungover from yesterday doing? Solidarity.
Yeah.
Solidarity. So thank you all. My brain is racing, and so like Camila and Dina have these notes that are in paragraphs, and I have like this. So if I say like buy 12 eggs, it's also because my shopping list is on here. Both of these people brought up really, really important and sort of like daunting understandings of the way sexual violence and the state intersect, especially on the bodies of like feminized people, trans people, women, people of color, gender non-binary, gender non-conforming non-binary folks, right? And so how many of y'all are from Chicago? All right, so I can tell everybody, I can just make up shit and nobody's gonna check me. Because I want to talk to you a little bit about the work that Love and Protect does, which is an intervention on multiple things. One, on the criminal legal system in and of itself, the PIC. So we are an abolitionist organization, and we're really dedicated to burning down all the prisons and then building roller rinks where they belong. Accessible roller rinks. And also we want to intervene on what Camila pointed out to as the like non-repressive arms of the state apparatus, which are actually repressive arms of the state apparatus, because there is always the specter of violence, and violence looks like getting services taken away from you or not being given access. And for us specifically, we work with survivors of domestic and sexual violence that have been criminalized for their survival. And so I want to be clear about certain things. For example, we tend not to extract what we call domestic or interpersonal relationship violence from sexual violence or sexual assault, because very often if you are in an abusive relationship that's an intimate partnership, sexual violence is part of it, right? And also, all types of sexual violence happen in relationship and in community and through relationships and community, right? So like these things, like the state and neoliberalism, and like I'm going to argue the Me Too movement as well, like really encourages us to think about victimhood and perpetration as a singular person causing the singular harm to another singular person, when that's so rarely the case. And those of us who work in Love and Protect think about that in the way that we work as a community-based solution for certain kinds of things. Solution is so not the right word, and intervention is what I'm gonna keep saying. So stick with me. Are you still here?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, picture it. Chicago, 2013, right? 2013, our friend Miriam and her organization, Project Nia, brought together a teach-in around the case of Marissa Alexander. Who has heard of Marissa Alexander? Who wants to talk about Marissa's case briefly? This person in the amazing Eileen Warnos t-shirt that I've been coveting for 10 minutes. Right? It's so good. Please, if you feel comfortable, show everybody your swag, first of all. And
look up Eileen Warnos.
Yes.
So really quick, Marissa Alexander was in an abusive relationship with her husband in Florida. People might remember Florida from when Trayvon Martin was murdered. Mm-hmm. And she was on her property, and she shot at him to protect herself, and then she was arrested. Mm-hmm. And she's still in prison, I believe. She was released.
We're gonna talk about that in a minute, but thank you. So Marissa Alexander defended herself. So like, if you look on paper, aside from the fact that she was a black woman, she is quote unquote an ideal victim. She had an MBA. She went to church. She was married in the church. She was married in the eyes of the state. She had her kids, blah, 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 right? And so she was even a legal gun owner. She shot this gun above the head of her abuser, who was threatening to kill her, because that's what abusers do sometimes. And she fired a warning shot. Because of the sort of like excesses of the state, and I would argue, like, if we're living in a post Violence Against Women Act world where somebody's going to jail for this shit, right? Strike one. Marissa ended up going to jail because she was seen as the aggressor, right? And so this is really, really typical, right? So many times when someone who is seen as like already troublesome because of your social location, when you decide to defend yourself, like, you are the aggressor. Mm-hmm. So you, as a survivor of violence, have two options: die or go to jail, which is also a social death and an actual physical death for many people, right? And so she chose to defend herself, and then she was punished for it, right? And so what took a long time to happen, but eventually did, was the rise of various defense committees. And these defense committees, do people know what a defense committee is? A defense committee is sort of like, it's very often a community-based strategy that we saw a lot of African-American groups in this country start to help decarcerate their people from inside, right? So like, if someone would, this is like a result of and a reaction to sort of Jim Crow era, like incarceration, like the rise of mass incarceration post Jim Crow, right? And so we would see groups of people say, like, this person does not belong in jail. We as a community are going to raise funds to contribute to their legal defense. We're going to raise awareness nationally and internationally, and we're going to get them out. And we've seen this happen starting from the time of slavery to this country. And sort of the most notable defense committees before Marissa Alexander was for someone named Joanne Little, or you can call her Joan. I put an extra syllable in there because I can, because she's not coming for me, because she's nice. But so like Joan Little's case, what made international headlines, and we saw a really unprecedented allegiance between African-American radical organizations, African-American sort of like respectability politics organizations, white ladies, which, you know, like, no offense, but sometimes they're not super helpful. And like, you know, like, it was one of the moments in our history, which is not too far away, it was in the 70s, where we saw a mass movement to free this woman who defended herself against a sexual assault, right? And so the same sort of thing happened for Marissa Alexander. And after this teach-in in Chicago, we came together as the Chicago Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander. And we did a lot, arguably too much. We raised a lot of money such that even post her getting out of jail, she had to take a plea, we'll talk about that in a minute. Post getting out of jail, she was put on electronic monitoring, and of course you have to pay for that as the person who's being monitored. So we helped her finance that, for example. We helped, like, not only Chicago, but across the nation, people contributed financially to her, but we also did a lot in terms of supporting her emotionally. So there were massive letter writing campaigns, which, what we know about prisons is that anything you can do to intervene on the isolation and social death of prison is like very important and remarkable. But when you think about someone who has also been trapped in the cycle of an abusive relationships rely on the survivor believing that they are isolated and alone, right? And so not only was Marissa and all survivors, not only are they confronted with the like trauma of being isolated in their relationships, when they go into prison, they are also like isolated. And so part of the work we did with Marissa was to help intervene on that and to remind her and the people who were running the prisons and jails that people cared about her and were working for her, right? And so Marissa's story ends somewhat positively, right? Like, all this mass mobilization happened, and she was able to figure out, like, she was able to get a retrial, right? And unfortunately, because this is often the non-choice given survivors, she took a guilty plea so she could just get back to her families. And this is, her family, now families, because she has international family. Mm-hmm. Like, this is what happens very, very often with perpetrators, you know, with survivors and perpetrators, right? They become conflated, so I don't like to make those binaries. And so Marissa took a plea, She is out and free, and she is like living. She is always in the goddamn gym, and I don't even know how she does that. She Facebook lives, and she's like, I'm like a magnificent activist, right? And she had this vast international following and vast international support network, which we know does not happen for most survivors who defend themselves against violence and then are incarcerated as a result. And so the Chicago Alliance to Free Marissa Alexander, we took a hard look at ourselves and we decided that what we do best is we do support really, really well. And so we shifted from a defense committee that's explicitly about taking on an individual case and trying to decarcerate an individual person to being a support committee for people. And what does support look like? And this is where we sort of intervene on the like non-repressive apparatuses of the state. Like when you are an incarcerated survivor, you like prison and jail is not where you go to get trauma-informed care, right? And so prison and jail is also where you don't go to get a maxi pad, right? And so like that's part of what Love and Protect does, is that we try to reduce the isolation by giving people direct support. That direct support, it comes in the form of letter writing and relationship building, but it also comes in like straight up material support, as in putting money on people's books. Because what gets invisibilized is it's like really expensive to go to prison, right? And you are literally paying for what is perceived to be a crime, right? And you are paying in multiple ways, like in your humanity, but also with your cash money, right? Like you might have to save up a month's worth of salary or wages to buy a fucking ramen, and that's just like inhumane. So one of the things that Survived and Punished does is that we just give people money. We don't ask them what they're doing with their money. We don't ask them even to write us back. Like we write one letter and we say, hey, we would like to support you. We heard about you through so-and-so. You can write us back if you want and we can form a relationship, but we can also just put $25 on your books. And this is a radical departure from the way any fucking social service agency works. Because you don't, like social service agencies require you to perform a certain sort of ideal victimhood that no one actually can keep up. It asks you to perform a certain form of gratitude that no one pretends that you keep up. And it asks you to like constantly aver this idea of you're like being innocent or like an innocent victim or this and the, and that's not the point. We want to see people as full people. We want to get them out and we want to support them through those things, but if they just need fucking $25 a month and a few letters from some like people who wear purple apparently every single day of the year. We didn't plan this. Like we do that for them, right? And then, so like what this means is that we have struggled with like understanding our place as a support committee for people in relationship to the way other sort of supports are lent to survivors of sexual violence, right? So like many of us in Love and Protect are part of Love and Protect because we spent decades upon decades in traditional social service, like academic-based, like victim services. And those victim services are as, if not more so, repressive and require as much from the people you're allegedly trying to help, right? But what we know is that, A, this dichotomy between a victim and a criminal is a false binary, right? All binaries are false, right? Like they're fucked up. And also like respect, it's on the thing. And then also like, you know, like what we also understand is that our intervention, like that support, that intervention work is as important as the overt defense work. And what we're also laying the groundwork for is the belief that people eventually will come out and they will need to come into community. Right, and what happened to people is like when they were in an abusive relationship, their communities either participated in the abuse or did not create any sanctuary for them. And what we want to do is while we are strangers to them when we first meet them, we want to let people know that they are not alone, right? And I think that one of the things that abolitionist movements really need to start thinking through is what does care and support look like in an as part of an abolitionist practice. And one of the things that mainstream feminism has really failed to do, like they have commodified and neoliberalized care in a way that really sent them on a direct path to the criminal legal system and the PIC. And we have to walk that back and imagine a world where abolition also entails care and support, and understanding that patterns of violence and patterns of power and control and the harms that come from them, like, come from the communities that we build and the communities that we isolate people from. And so those are kind of, like, that's kind of how Love and Protect started. We are constantly evolving. So most of us who are in Love and Protect are also in relationship to the Chicago Community Bond Fund, because we understand that for many criminalized survivors, when they are arrested, part of what helps keep them inside is an inability to pay cash bond, right? Especially if they have cases of murder, right? And that has been really complicated too. Like, that's been actually very, very heartbreaking. And we also are thinking through sort of ideas of, mass clemency and commutation. And these are actions that are happening across the country, which is really amazing to get criminalized survivors out. But we also have to start thinking through what does the outside look like, and what structures and what communities are we building to welcome folks home. All right, thank you.